I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. 10 Democrats took to the stage last night in Atlanta for the fifth presidential primary debate in a race that is still competitive and still attracting new candidates. Hosted by MSNBC and The Washington Post, they were asked about a wide range of issues: health care, a wealth tax, climate change, abortion, wars, foreign policy, child care, race, trade, and who best is suited to beat President Trump. The current frontrunners, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, former Vice President Joe Biden, and Mayor Pete Buttigieg, represent the liberal-moderate split within the party. The other candidates, Senators Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar, and Kamala Harris, Representative Tulsi Gabbard, entrepreneur Andrew Yang, and billionaire businessman Tom Steyer, did not play second fiddle last night to the presumptive leaders. The debate came just an hour after the end of an impeachment hearing inquiry with damning testimony against President Trump and his administration. Today on Radio Times, what did last night reveal about the candidates, the party, and the race for the White House? We've got clips lined up, and we've got three guests who have joined us for the hour. Here in our Philadelphia studios, T.J. Rooney, former chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, also founder and president of Tri-State Strategies PA, and co-founder of the Rooney Novak Eisenhower Group. And T.J. Rooney, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be
here. Good morning. Will Bunch is with us as well. He's a national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You can also read him at Inquirer.com. And Will, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And joining us from Princeton on Skype is LaFleur Stevens-Dugan. She's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. She's got a forthcoming book, Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. And LaFleur, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you all with us. Let me begin with some broad-based questions, and perhaps, TJ, I will begin with you. Did we learn anything new last night?
I don't think we did. No, I think people pretty much played to script, and I didn't learn anything new.
How about, I'm always wondering about that person who's just now paying attention to politics and the race, Will. Do you think someone who's sat down for the first time to watch a debate among the Democrats came away with a certain impression?
Maybe if they were watching it for the first time, only because I do think really all 10 candidates on the stage basically were who they were. You know, they did a good job laying out their platforms. You know, the problem is a lot of these people have watched all five debates and were kind of rolling their eyes. It was really weird, too, to be honest, to have this with the backdrop of impeachment, because
just an hour, really, after the close of the impeachment hearings yesterday.
Right. And so people didn't focus beforehand. You know, I saw people on Twitter kind of like, oh, my gosh, do I have to watch this? And then I was up early this morning at 5, so it was just really like 5 or 6 hours after this thing had ended. And CNN did a whole hour of, I think maybe they mentioned it at 5:57. Right. You know, I mean, it was impeachment. So it's a weird backdrop for them to try and get their message across.
Well, we're going to be talking about impeachment tomorrow. So,
yeah, right.
So for our listeners, we have not forgotten that. LaFleur, we had four women moderators last night. Did that bring anything new to the debate?
Yeah, I think it really speaks to who's in the room and who gets to have a seat at the table. And you can see with some of the questions that they asked, particularly around paid family leave and childcare, that I think those are issues that have gotten short shrift. But with an all-female team, they got brought to the fore last night.
I noticed even abortion got some coverage last night as well, which I think, LaFleur, was was a bit unusual.
Yeah, I'd agree. Again, you know, it was, I would say, for the most part, still pretty much a status quo debate. But you saw at different points, particularly the women candidates, trying to make a case for themselves. And most notably, I think of Klobuchar, for example, who, you know, she had that great zinger about basically, if you think a woman can't beat Donald Trump, you're wrong, noting that Nancy Pelosi does it every day. And so I thought that was really interesting, given some of the gender dynamics as well.
We have a clip of that queued up, and let me just do a quick description of it. And this is Senator Amy Klobuchar responding to a question about her criticism of Mayor Pete Buttigieg's lack of experience, where she does talk about women candidates. Let's give it a listen.
First of all, I've made very clear, I think, that Pete is qualified to be up on this stage, and I am honored to be standing next to him. But what I said was true. women are held to a higher standard. Otherwise, we could play a game called Name Your Favorite Woman President, which we can't do because it has all been men, including all vice presidents being men. And I think any working woman out there, any woman that's at home, knows exactly what I mean. We have to work harder, and that's a fact.
TJ, does she have a point?
Oh, my God, candidate. Yeah. Absolutely, 100%. And she makes a very – or she makes her points in a very compelling way because of the candidates outside of the top three or four, she really does have – see, my prism for all this is because I really do want to defeat this president. And my prism is who can win Pennsylvania. It makes the math a lot easier because trying to figure out 18 people, you know, everybody claims to have a pathway. Amy Klobuchar actually could have a pathway in Pennsylvania. There's no doubt about it. And, if you have a pathway in Pennsylvania, you have a pathway in Ohio, in Michigan, and certainly in Minnesota and Wisconsin. So, yeah, she makes very compelling points in a very authentic and compelling way.
Well, it is interesting to look at the Democratic Party, which describes itself as a Big Ten. And there are these ideological splits. And I do think the four front runners represent that. You've got Biden and Buttigieg on one side, and you've got Sanders and Warren on the other side.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, this is the 10th presidential election I've covered. And I really can't remember a time where the lanes, as we now call them in the current vernacular, have been so jammed, you know, with people in each lane. Where you've got, you know, I mean, you could look at the Democratic electorate and say probably 40% of it is pretty far to the left. But you have Sanders and Warren splitting that in two, which puts them back down to like 20%. And now you're starting to see the same thing. I mean, Biden was way ahead because he was really dominating the center. But I think his stumbles gave an opening for Buttigieg. And the real key is I think nobody knows where African-American voters are going to go in this election. And until we get a better sense of that, I don't think anybody who makes a prediction on who's going to win this thing knows what they're talking about, to be honest.
LaFleur, let me get you in on that issue, because this is something that you know a lot about. And we talk about, you know, African-American voters as if it's the sort of one sort of block, when it, of course, it is as diverse as any other part of racial or ethnic groups. How do you see, though, the so-called black vote?
Yeah, you know, I think that Will is right on that respect, that the path to the Democratic nomination is really going to come through black voters. And they're not a monolith. So what we're really seeing, I think, is a divide between older black voters, those black voters over 50 who are throwing their support behind Biden. And I'd argue that that's largely an issue of name recognition more so than his record. I know he keeps on touting his ties to Obama, but I think, it's still open in terms of where even older black voters, they can potentially switch, is my point. Mm-hmm. For younger black voters, I see more support really among the sort of more leftist candidates, and particularly with black women, a lot of them getting behind an Elizabeth Warren candidacy, someone who's spoken very openly and frequently about, quote unquote, their issues.
Well, let me play Kamala Harris. And again, this is from last night's debate, and she is answering a question about black voter support for the Democratic Party.
When black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in connection with childbirth in America, when the sons of black women will die because of gun violence more than any other cause of death, when black women make 61 cents on the dollar as compared to all women who tragically make 80 cents on the dollar, the question has to be, where you been and what are you going to do? And do you understand who the people are?
TJ, does the Democratic Party take black women voters for granted?
Well, if we have over the course of time, now would be a great time to stop, because as everybody has suggested, black women voters are the backbone of our party. So it makes logically good sense to advance policies that have resonance and appeal within that community. And truthfully, as we talked about a little bit earlier, I thought Senator Harris would be the person who would be the recipient Of that African-American support should Vice President Biden lose it. I'm really kind of shocked that she hasn't emerged in the top tier, because she's incredibly talented, has that prosecutorial background that plays like a fiddle in Pennsylvania, and really, I think, had the hopefully still has, but certainly I thought had the potential to really make a go of this in a very serious way.
Let me toss that back to you, LaFleur. Why do you think Kamala Harris then hasn't made more progress, especially among Black voters and especially among Black women voters?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting, but I think this speaks to a sophistication of Black voters. You know, when we saw Obama run in 2008 and 2012, there was this sort of narrative that Black people were voting for the Black candidate and they just support any old Black candidate. And what we're seeing here is that Black voters don't necessarily just go for the Black candidate in the race, but they go for candidates who they deem both electable and concerned with interests of the Black community. And so, for, I think, a multitude of reasons, Harris is not connecting on that dimension. I think for many African Americans, she's maybe lacking a sort of authenticity. She has the sort of bona fides on paper. You know, she went to a historically Black college and university. She pledged, you know, the first African American sorority. But when it comes to more sort of substantive things, namely, that same prosecutorial background, I think that's actually a detractor, particularly for younger Black voters.
Will, you want to add to that?
Yeah, and it's funny because I think Kamala Harris had a great debate last night. I thought she was really strong. And when you see her on that debate stage, those tend to be her best moments, because she's extremely charismatic, maybe the most charismatic Democrat in the field. I mean, you can see her on that debate stage with President Trump just taking it to him, and just as she's done in Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, like with the Kavanaugh hearings. And yet you really see all the moving parts it takes to become president of the United States. And she doesn't have all those moving parts in place. You know, she really seems to be uninterested in policy and has shifted her position on some issues. You know, and there's inside baseball. She has not put together a major league staff. You see how that plays out.
Well, we're almost up on a break here, TJ, but speak to that, if you would. And this is the stuff that I think most people don't see, but just having a team of people that know how to get the job done, how important that is.
It's incredibly important. And the only difference minor difference I would have with Will is that I think she really does have a pretty good team. It's just that it's not functioning the way it's supposed to. She's got some really good fundraising people that some of them emanate from here, hail from Philadelphia. She's got good talent, but it's how you use that talent to drive the effort. And it seems, you know, when people get bogged down in personal stuff that has nothing to do with the candidate or nothing to do with the campaign, this is what you get.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about last night's debate among the Democratic candidates for president. There were 10 of them on the stage in Atlanta. T.J. Rooney, former chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, founder and president of Tri-State Strategies, PA. Will Bunch, national political columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You can also read him at theinquirer.com. And LaFleur Stevens-Dugan. She's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoing, talking with LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, Will Bunch, and T.J. Rooney about last night's fifth Democratic presidential primary debate. Let me play another clip from the debate, and this was really from the very top when Elizabeth Warren and the other candidates were asked about the impeachment process and also the testimony yesterday coming from Ambassador Sondland. Let's give it a listen, and we'll talk about it.
How did Ambassador Sondland get there? You know, this is not a man who had any qualifications except one. He wrote a check for $1 million. And that tells us about what's happening in Washington, the corruption, how money buys its way into Washington. You know, I raised this months ago about the whole notion that donors think they're going to get ambassadorships on the other side. And I've taken a pledge. Anyone who wants to give me a big donation, don't ask to be an ambassador, because I'm not going to have that happen.
LaFleur, how important do you think in this whole impeachment inquiry process is to voters in terms of how they think about the candidates, the issue, and President Trump?
Well, you know, I think for the Democratic primary electorate, they are behind impeachment. The bigger issue, though, I think, is that they are not the entire country. Right. So for these candidates who are trying to play to their primary base, but also looking towards a general election, I think they're kind of really having to walk a tightrope there. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But sure. It's also really hard to differentiate the candidates because they're all essentially behind impeachment.
Do you think, TJ, and I'm thinking you're here because you understand Pennsylvania and understand Democrats in Pennsylvania. Do you think this whole impeachment investigation, this probe, all this media attention on impeachment is something that resonates with voters in Pennsylvania, especially Democratic voters?
Unfortunately, it depends where you're talking about said voters. In the Southeast, there's no question about it. We've seen now three cycles that just are telling in how this motivates Democrats to get out and vote. As Will and I were briefly discussing on the way in, the irony is that in southwestern Pennsylvania, the complete opposite is occurring. And I'll just leave you with something that I experienced a few weeks ago speaking to the Pennsylvania Association of Broadcasters. To a person from the Northeast to the Northwest, they all said that they didn't think the president was as strong as he was in 2016, but rather they thought he was stronger. So,
and this is in Pennsylvania.
We are talking about a tale of two states in terms of our politics. And it's that individual who has the ability to appeal to a large swath of voters that Democrat that has that ability will be the one that succeeds in Pennsylvania.
Well, you were nodding your head. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, as Trump gets deeper and deeper into his presidency, you see this wedge where the people who are anti-Trump, you know, the people in the Philadelphia suburbs, for example, who really, really dislike the president, you know, dislike him more than ever, you know, or more behind impeachment. But the thing that makes him so popular in a place like Washington County or Greene County, Pennsylvania, is his ability to drive suburban white liberals crazy, right? So, you know, so the more impeachment drives people like some of my neighbors out in Delco crazy, the more they rally behind the president. And, you know, so you saw for all the publicity locally here in Philadelphia about wins in Delaware County and Chester County for Democrats. You had losses for Democrats in Washington County and in some of these counties outside of Pittsburgh. You just had a state senator in Luzerne County,
right,
formerly a rock-solid Democratic base, went for Trump in 2016, leave the Democratic Party. He's not looking at impeachment and saying, you know, I don't want anything to do with those Republicans. He's going to caucus with the Republicans because he thinks that's the way the Scranton area is going. So you really do see that. And, you know, in terms of how impeachment plays out in the primaries, I mean, you know, the vast majority of Democrats support impeachment and there's not much difference between the candidates. The way it plays out is the anxiety about electability. You know, the people, you know, that's where you see it. It's not what are they specifically saying about Trump. It's who can beat this guy.
Well, and I guess that is always a question, LaFleur, in these debates, which is which of these people, looking at how they behave in a debate, which of them can take on the president? Are we getting an inkling, an answer to that question?
Unfortunately, I would say no. It's unclear to me who's really emerging as a sort of standout candidate that everyone in the primary electorate can unite behind. We see, you know, for example, Mayor Pete, I think he's trying to position himself as someone who's that moderate who can beat Trump, but at the same time is able to galvanize younger voters. But it's not actually bearing itself out in his poll numbers with the younger voters. He's not especially popular with them. And I mean, we can see each of these candidates making a case for why they're electable and why they can beat Trump. But I don't know if anyone has really emerged as the definitive candidate.
Has anyone emerged for you, TJ?
Well, I hate to be the wet blanket, but here we go. Yeah. Well, no, nobody has emerged as the candidate, but I have to confess and concede that there are some that I do believe are not electable in Pennsylvania. And I speak specifically, about Senators Warren and Sanders. I do not believe that they will be able to carry the state. And as I said before, ergo, if you can't win here, it makes Ohio, Minnesota, it makes all those states that we are used to winning a lot more difficult.
Why though? And well, then I do want to play a clip, but go ahead from Sanders, but go ahead.
For a myriad of reasons. I mean, and I do think most of it centers around Medicare for All. There are many, many unions that have represented benefit packages for their members across Pennsylvania, including most especially in places like southwestern Pennsylvania. The idea that you would replace those hard-earned and negotiated benefits with something that, of Elizabeth Warren's liking, is something that is antithetical to those men and women. And many of those are those working those Reagan Democrats, if you want to call them. And I understand it's fashionable in some circles to kind of poo-poo the old Reagan Democrat. But, you know, when you add up the votes on election night, at the end of the day, if you don't have at least some of them, you got none. You got no victory. And that's, you know, maybe I wish things maybe were different, but they're not.
Well, let me play a clip from Bernie Sanders from last night. And it's and his answer to a question about climate change. Let's give it a listen and then I'll give you a chance to respond.
What we have got to do tonight, and I will do as president, is to tell the fossil fuel industry that their short-term profits are not more important than the future of this planet. And by the way, the fossil fuel industry is probably criminally liable because they have lied and lied and lied when they had the evidence that their carbon products were destroying the planet. And maybe we should think about prosecuting them as well.
Thank you, Senator Sanders.
We'll lock up the fossil fuel industry.
And you know what? That is going to be music to the ears of voters under the age of 30. And the Democrats are not going to win without those voters. You know, listening to TJ, he made a lot of great points. I honestly don't disagree with anything he said. And especially, you know, I'm a union member myself with one of those insurance plans. So I understand where he's coming from. But there's a flip side to this, and it's very important. I think people forget this sometimes. When you look at states like Pennsylvania that Hillary Clinton lost by roughly 40,000 votes. I forget the exact number now. But when you look at a state like that, why did she lose? She lost because African-Americans in Philadelphia did not turn out at exactly the same percentage as they did for Obama. And she lost because young people either stayed home or, you know, a lot of them got duped, I have to say, by Jill Stein's Green Party campaign. And if you don't think that's going to happen again in 2020, I think you're being very nice. Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I think
she's still running, right?
Well, I don't know who the Green Party will run. And, you know, there's rumors about Tulsi Gabbard, you know, becoming a third party candidate. And, you know, it drives me crazy as an analyst sometimes that all the people analyzing the 2020 race get amnesia about how 2016 actually played out, because you know, they look at the poll numbers and we don't know who the, you know, Gary Johnson libertarian is going to be. You know, Lincoln Chafee, the former governor of Rhode Island, might run. There's talk of that. No one's paying attention to that. No one's paying attention to the fact that Green Party is going to run. And let's say, you know, Mr. Electable Joe Biden gets the nomination. He may not be that electable because there's going to be a million Facebook ads, some of them paid for by the Trump campaign, some of them paid for by Vladimir Putin, probably, that are going to run on African-American Facebook pages saying Joe Biden was against busing. Joe Biden doesn't support African Americans. Don't vote for him. You know, young people are going to, young people are going to see Facebook ads portraying Biden as a tool of the big oil, and or being anti-climate change. And you're going to see that play out again. I think a Warren or a Sanders, or a liberal candidate could get that turnout and that excitement that could give you that 40,000 votes. So that's where I disagree with TJ to some extent.
Let me just.
I agree.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Agree with Will here on that point, because when we think about places, you know, we're talking about who can win Pennsylvania, but turning Black voters out and young people in a place like Philly, you know, when we think about Hillary losing Wisconsin, there's Black people and young people in Milwaukee. You know, the list can go on. Detroit, Michigan. And so, again, this is the debate that the party is always facing, which is whether to kind of go after those Reagan Democrats or those Obama to Trump voters. And that's one path to victory. But I think it's actually maybe more likely to be a losing path. You know, those voters, a lot of them have left the party. And so I think what we were hearing in some of the comments, even by Senator Harris last night, is what are you going to do for Black voters and what can you do to get them energized into the polls? Because I don't think Joe Biden, for the most part, is going to do it. And neither is a Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Let me just quickly reintroduce all three of you. That's LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, and she's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. Will Bill Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. T.J. Rooney was the chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party for some time. He's now founder and president of Tri-State Strategies PA and co-founder of the Rooney Novak Eisenhower Group, talking about last night's presidential debate among the Democrats for the primary, of course, and what it reveals about the candidates, also what it reveals about the party. Let me quote something that President Obama said recently, and he's been pretty quiet, but he has on occasion spoken up about what he sees happening in his party and also in the country. He said, this is still a country that is less revolutionary than it is interested in improvement. They like seeing things improved, but the average American doesn't think that we have to completely tear down the system and remake it. And I think it's important for us not to lose sight of that. LaFleur, if I can go back to you, and there was some talk last night about reconstituting the Obama coalition. What kind of clout do you think President Obama has among Democrats?
I think he has quite a bit of clout still. They are definitely, I mean, anyone would be happy to have his endorsement. And of course, Joe Biden sort of touting that he does implicitly. So his opinion does matter, but I do think he's underestimating the sort of sense among the primary base and even the general electorate for a tearing down of the system. And I mean, if people weren't sort of sympathetic to that framework, I don't think we'd have a Trump presidency. So I think he might be a little off base there to some degree, actually.
I posted the Obama's comments on our Facebook page yesterday afternoon. We got a bunch of comments. I'll read just a couple of them, and TJ, then I'll turn to you. John says, I love this good man, Obama, but I was frustrated by his lack of daring in addressing some of the most controversial issues during his presidency. It was the party's centrist line that produced a lackluster voter turnout, especially among independents. Playing it safe is sometimes a dangerous strategy. A Facebook comment from Joshua. I like Obama and all, but we live in a country where the center is actually ridiculously to the right. A Facebook comment from Marcy. Although I am philosophically more left of center, I believe that in order to win an election, you have to be more centrist to get the much needed independence. TJ, let me give you a chance to weigh in on what Obama said, and there's been a lot of reaction to it.
Sure. I agree with Marcy and the president. I mean, there's and I understand that there's a lot of desire to have bigger, more bold change. But this is, and again, I hate to be a broken record, but it's Pennsylvania. And it's about, for me, it's about winning and losing. I don't like litmus tests. I don't apply them to candidates. I don't see, I guess I'm sure the frustration with LaFleur and Will with me would be that I don't see what they see in terms of the electorate clamoring to go much, much, much farther left than we're accustomed to. My fear is that, and yes, I do agree that 30-somethings and all of the constituency groups that have been referred to are incredibly important. But I would just respectfully admonish you to consider that if we nominate somebody such as Senator Sanders or Warren, we're going to lose a lot of other people. You know, it's like squeezing the old balloon. We squeeze it out west and it sank and it popped out here. It's threading a needle. This is about threading a needle to defeat somebody who is unfit to serve as president of the United States. And I just don't know that this is, and I'm sure this isn't something to be criticized for having said before, but I don't know that this is the time to experiment or push the envelope farther than we believe it is possible to push it and expect a result that is acceptable to us.
Let me toss to you, Will, but I'm also thinking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, obviously won, gotten a lot of attention, but so did Connor Lamb win in Western Pennsylvania. He is very much a...
He won 170 precincts that Donald Trump won.
And he doesn't get much attention. But nonetheless, I wonder whether, in certain ways, looking at the Democratic Party, those are the two poles that we're looking at. So you've got, I mean, she's a progressive. She's, you know, even very progressive and obviously gets a lot of attention and kudos for that.
Yeah, you know, it's a Rubik's Cube, you know, for the Democrats trying to like spin this thing around and get the face all one color, and you can't because something's always out of alignment, you know. If you know, not that they're running for president, but yeah, Ocasio-Cortez would be too far left, and but Connor Lamb would, you know, alienate her supporters, her younger supporters. You know,
it's the Goldilocks candidate, right? That's sort of just about right.
And that candidate hasn't. There've been 20. You know, how many? 27 people at various times have been running, and none of them has been able to come up with the right formula. But, you know, I mean, one thing we haven't talked about yet is this recent development of people like Mike Bloomberg and Deval Patrick at the last minute thinking 25 wasn't enough, that what they really wanted was somebody like me. And I think there's a misreading of the electorate. You know, I think the people who are clamoring for, you know, revolutionary change, whether it's getting rid of college debt or, you know, a real honest to God universal health care, and the people clamoring for those things, you can't put that genie back in the bottle. I mean, I think Obama, with his comments to some degree, I mean, they're trying to pretend that it can be just, you know, put away, but it's too late. You know, I think decades of structural inequality in this country have, you know, made it impossible to shut that conversation up.
LaFleur, about a minute before our second break here, but there was several references to the sort of reviving the Obama coalition. Does that coalition exist without Obama?
That's a good question. I think that, that's great. His coalition is, I don't know if we can quite recreate that. And I think each of these candidates is talking about a way that they think that they can do that. We saw, you know, Mayor Pete make references to that with the coalition that has gotten behind his rights to, you know, wear a wedding ring and, you know, wanting to create some of that coalition again. I think Kamala Harris spoke to some of that as well. Obama was able to thread that needle in a way that I don't know if any of these candidates are quite able to. I think we thought maybe Senator Harris would have been that person, but, you know, it looks like her star is sort of fading fast.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we'll actually play that Mayor Pete Buttigieg clip after this short break. That's LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, and again, she's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. Will Bunch, national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. T.J. Rooney, former chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, and he is co-founder of the Rooney-Novak Eisenhower Group. We're talking about the Democrats, last night's debate, what it reveals about the party and their chances of beating President Trump. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guests, T.J. Rooney, LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, and Will Bunch, about the Democrats, about last night's debate, their chances here in the state of Pennsylvania, which is, in many ways, I don't know if it's T.J., or the battleground state, but clearly the race will be fought here in 2020. Let me play another clip from last night. This is Mayor Pete Buttigieg. He's responding to a question about his ability and interest in standing up for African-American communities.
And I care about this because while I do not have the experience of ever having been discriminated against because of the color of my skin, I do have the experience of sometimes feeling like a stranger in my own country, turning on the news and seeing my own rights come up for debate, and seeing my rights expanded by a coalition of people like me and people not at all like me, working side by side, shoulder to shoulder, making it possible for me to be standing here wearing this wedding ring in a way that couldn't have happened two elections ago, lets me know just how deep my obligation is to help those whose rights are on the line every day, even if they are nothing like me in their experience.
LaFleur, it's interesting, if you look at Iowa, and I think even New Hampshire, you see Pete Buttigieg really pulling ahead. But among African-American voters, almost no, it doesn't, he hardly registers at all. Is there an answer to that?
Well, he did come up with his Frederick Douglass plan.
He
but
did.
Again, I think that he doesn't have that sort of name recognition. You know, we started earlier talking about, like, for someone who just tunes in, you know, the average voter is not necessarily paying, you know, close attention to these debates and following the race that closely. So for Mayor Pete, I think a lot of his problem is maybe that voters just don't know him well. And he's just also not as, I think, as articulate on the issues of race in mm-hmm. some of the ways that some of the other candidates have had sort of more practice and just come off with a greater sense of authenticity. And I think that even speaks to some of the same struggles that we saw Bernie Sanders having in the last election cycle with connecting mm-hmm. with Black voters as well.
How do you see Pete Buttigieg, especially in Pennsylvania, TJ?
Well, he's obviously exceedingly brilliant and has put together an effort that, you know, he's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana.
He's gotten less than 11,000 votes.
Yeah, but he's always
That's
been.
The
I mean,
max.
We should also make no bones about the fact that he is the president. President Obama has always loved Pete Buttigieg. There was a period of time in the not too distant past where they really wanted him to be chairman of the Democratic National Committee. That didn't materialize. So if you can't get that, you run for president. But he's doing a tremendous job. The thing that I find, and I say this not to be compelling or anything of the sort, but I find it fascinating that as a means to draw an analogy with Black voters to being disaffected, he would use his homosexuality. It's just a very compelling. It's in some respects completely antithetical to the approach you think you might poll test or focus group. So it's interesting. I found that more interesting than anything else, because I don't know that that is necessarily the nail you would hang on the wall mm-hmm. to buttress that.
But he said it, and
oh yeah, no, he
obviously
went there.
Had thought that. Yeah. How do you see that, Will?
Well, I think LaFleur was right, and I think there's even more to it in the fact that, you know, his ability to not connect with Black voters. I mean, when you look at the things that many, not all, obviously, but many African-American voters are looking for. It's, you know, name ID is definitely a problem, but I think it's also they want experience. And like LaFleur said, they want people who've been in the community, who've been to events and walked the streets and been to churches and know how to describe social justice or certain different situations in a certain way. And they also want experience. And there's a lot of pragmatism among Black voters, and they want somebody who can win. And you look at this guy who is younger than anyone who's ever been elected president, and he's only been the mayor of, you know, I mean, I don't think that disqualifies him, but he's only been mayor of a small mid-sized city, you know. So I think he has so many obstacles to overcome in the Black community, and that's why I don't think he can win the nomination, to be honest, because of that.
LaFleur, one of the candidates, I forget who it was last night, basically said, you know, you can't just go to a Black church and expect to get the Black vote.
Right.
Can you add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing on full stage here is that there's a sophistication of Black voters that was maybe not evident to people before. And in particular, you know, you asked me that question about the Obama coalition and if that could be recreated. And I think a lot of Black voters left that presidency whilst, you know, it was historic and symbolic, you know, disaffected to some degree, not really seeing their issues with a Black man in the White House being handled directly. And so I think they're, you know, maybe feeling like they're not going to fall for the okie doke this time around. And they want to see some substance in a way that it's unclear which of these candidates is going to offer. But just saying that, you know, I'm showing up to a church on Sunday, or that, you know, even say like a Bloomberg going to a Black church to apologize for his stop and frisk policy, I think voters are more sophisticated and want to see substance.
Let me read a couple of more comments. This was to President Obama basically saying, don't go too far left. You could lose the election. Amy says, so far, all these contenders in their own right are wonderful and competent, but vying against Trump, they are not going to win. None of them. They are far too left or not charismatic enough for the Trump celebrity era. Joseph says, roll out the progressive reforms after taking back the White House. Casey says, I'll take any Democrat who can beat Trump. Then we'll figure out the rebuilding part. It's going to take take some time. Hollis says Obama is too far left is way too far right, which is very interesting. Well, we're saving the best for last, and best by meaning the front runner. This would be Joe Biden. This is Vice President Biden last night answering a question about whether candidates should discourage their supporters from chanting "lock it up" when it comes to President Trump.
And I don't think it's a good idea that we mock that we model ourselves after Trump and say "lock him up." Look, we have to bring this country together. Let's start talking civilly to people and tweeting. You know, the next president who starts tweeting should, anyway. It's about civility. We have to restore the soul of this country. And that's not who we are. That's not who we've been. That's not who we should be.
TJ, on the one hand, Joe Biden is the front runner, I think, by most polls. Not in every state, obviously, but sort of broadly speaking. And he is not very good on the debate stage. It's such a curious disconnect.
Yeah, I mean, familiarity, his close association with the former president, all of those things, and a long, long record, distinguished record of service, are all things that, you know, I think people maybe overlook or don't. He's not perhaps as scrutinized as closely as some of the other candidates. You can claim that that's a failing, and ergo he is not going to be capable of standing toe to toe with the president. And other, you know, there are a lot of other people who would say he's just absolutely spot on. And how dare anybody suggest standing next to that president that, you know, a few gaffes here and there are going to be fatal, because, you know, he's only lied to us 13,000 times since he's been in office. So he's really, I mean, the president has done Joe Biden a great favor by taking the bar and disposing of it.
I wonder how you will see Joe Biden. And of course, you know, he and his son Hunter, so much of the impeachment discussion, I don't know whether that hurts him or helps him. But nonetheless, how do you see his candidacy?
Well, I think the impeachment has helped him a little bit. He's had a little bit of a bounce back. And I think it's because, you know, the reminder that of him being the anti-Trump is exactly what he wants for his campaign. You know, it was interesting that clip that you just played when he started talking about, oh, with the Twitter. I mean, he might as well have just said, get off my lawn, you know? I mean,
Twitter's where it's at, right?
Well, yeah, and just the way he talks about certain things, and he's had a number of those moments. And, you know, I understand, you know, I still talk about dad rock and stuff, and people roll their eyes, you know, so I get it. But, you know, it's hard. Again, just to go back to what I, you know, it's fascinating because when Warren started to rise in the polls, there were so many questions for Warren about whether she was going to be, quote, Hillary'd, unquote, meaning, you know, whether, you know, the Trump, you know, whoever Trump's weird allies are, using the same tactics they used to take down Hillary Clinton. I think Biden's the one in this race who would get Hillary, because you know, he'll be, like as I said before, I think he'll be vulnerable to a Facebook campaign that tries to get young people and African Americans to stay home. And I think, you know, these gaffes that we kind of maybe laugh off, these gaffes are going to be the Facebook clips saying, "Do you really want this guy?" You know, his 77th birthday was yesterday, I believe. Do you really want this guy in the White House?
Well, and LaFleur, just comparing his speaking style to the nine other people on the stage last night, he does fumble words. He has a hard time sometimes finishing a sentence. And I don't know if that's a disqualifier, but I know when I hear him speak, I get nervous that he's going to make it to the end of the sentence.
Yeah, or what's going to come at the end of that sentence. So, yeah, there are some ways in which he's just not seeming stage ready in the way that we might have thought he would have done, especially considering how well he performed in vice presidential debates in the past.
Right.
You know, when he's talking, you know, these gaffes, whether it's, you know, talking about a record player or like not really seeming familiar with Twitter, it's like he's just helping to fulfill this narrative that he's out of touch, that he's, you know, too far right, and he's not what, you know, is going to, or he's not who's going to mobilize young people and, you know, people of color. And he, I don't know, like even when he answered that question about his support among the Black community and framing himself as coming out of the Black community, even that was a bit awkward. And the way that he was able to deliver it. And of course, most notably forgetting that Kamala Harris was also on the stage and was, you know, the second African-American woman elected to the Senate.
Yeah, he had said something to the version of, I have the support of the only African-American woman ever elected to the Senate. That was Carol Moseley Brown. But of course, Kamala Harris sitting right there on the stage. He also made talking about domestic violence. We have to, quote, keep punching at it. We have to keep punching at it. His use of words are curious, I think.
Well, but, he's older. I mean I'm sure he'd love to grow a pompadour and get himself a scooter and you know, just jet about town. But it's the Joe we know, you
well,
know.
Well, let me ask you about Pennsylvania. I mean, sure. You're here to help us understand sure. Pennsylvania. You know, he's a Scranton-born person. He has roots here. He has connections here. How does Joe Biden play out in Pennsylvania?
I think he has an ability to win Pennsylvania. I don't dispute anything that Will or LaFleur have suggested about his shortcomings. But wait till Elizabeth Warren spends her time in the barrel. Wait till Bernie Sanders spends his time in the barrel. Wait till the rest of them spend their time in the barrel. I'm not so sure they're going to hold up as well as old Joe. So, you know, the Joe we know is better than I won't finish the sentence, but you know.
Oh, yeah. No, you must finish.
No.
We'll leave it out there. We'll leave it out there. Well, let me. There were a couple of other people on the stage, and we were talking during the break about Andrew Yang. He does have a big fan club, Will, because I noticed any time he was asked a question, there were cheers. When he answered, there were cheers. Who's his posse that seems to be so enthusiastic about him?
Well, when we're talking about Joe Biden on Twitter, I mean, this is the exact antithesis. He has used podcasts, for example, you know, Joe Rogan, world wrestling podcaster, huge following. And that's really when his campaign took off, when he went on, you know, and I'm sure 98% of Joe Biden supporters have never heard of Joe Rogan. But, you know, Andrew Yang is using that. He's using Twitter. He did a video with a hologram of himself. I mean, just, you know, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, and you've got to have something behind it. I mean, I've met Andrew, and I think he's a very smart guy.
You profiled him, right?
I profiled him for our mutual college alumni magazine, yeah. And, you know, I think he's a very smart guy. He went to the same college as me, right? So he's got to be smart. No, but he is smart. I mean, his signature proposal of $1,000 a month for every adult over 18.
It's intriguing.
It's different. And I think, you know, there's a lot of voters out there who want something very different. And Andrew Yang is that. So
LaFleur, let's end on a really gossipy, snarky note. What was going on between Tulsi Gabbard and Kamala Harris last night? Were you able to figure that out?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, I don't know if anyone is able to figure out Tulsi Gabbard, but seems like Senator Harris didn't really land the punch that I thought she would have. You know, they've had some back and forth since the last debate, and I didn't think she quite landed as strongly as she could have, actually.
I had to Google it because, like, what the heck is going on between these two women about Tulsi Gabbard being on Fox? And anyway, it's just sort of confusing. Anything you want to, any final words from you, TJ Rooney?
No, again, I just think that my prism in my own personal, you know, focus will be on looking at those candidates that I think have a chance of winning Pennsylvania. I'm not suggesting Joe Biden's the only one. There are others that I believe can win Pennsylvania.
Sure.
And, you know, I do have serious reservations about Mayor Pete, but he's brilliant and he's come a long way. So you can't sell him short. And I know it sounds crazy and perhaps she'll drop out tomorrow. But I still thought, and still a piece of me believes, Kamala Harris has a puncher's chance in all this. And I think she'd be acceptable to voters in this state.
LaFleur, you got 20 seconds. Your final thoughts.
My thought is that, again, I just want to reiterate that we need to stop focusing necessarily on that moderate voter, that Reagan Democrat, and really mobilize young people and people of color. And I think that's what's going to win the presidency for Democrats.
We're going to have you and TJ Rooney back to duke that out. Will Bunch, 30 seconds, 20 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, of the 10 races I've covered, I honestly can't remember one that going into the actual year, going into 2020, is so undecided. I don't think anybody can really make a prediction. You know, you've got four or five candidates who all have their 20%. You know, solids and a bunch of undecideds. And this thing could go all the way towards Milwaukee in next summer. It really could, you know.
Well, my thanks to all three of you. I really enjoyed our conversation talking about last night's debate. LaFleur Stevens-Dugan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she's an assistant professor of politics at Princeton University. Got a forthcoming book, Race to the Bottom, How Racial Appeals Work in American Politics. Will Bunch, as always, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Marty.
And he's national opinion columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. You can read him at Inquirer.com. T.J. Rooney, thank you for coming in as well.
It's a great pleasure.
And he's former chair of the Pennsylvania Democratic Party, founder and president of Tri-State Strategies, PA, and co-founder of the Rooney Novak Eisenhower Group. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.